Broadcasting live from the Cornish coast, this is the Monstrous Feminine podcast, the film club where we dissect the eerie intersections of gender in horror. My name's Mila, and I'm joined by my wildlife volunteers,
Louisa,
Taya,
and Zeba.
This is our last episode covering folk horror films. We're talking about the 2022 psychodrama Ennismain, directed by Mark Jenkin. Before we get into the film, go ahead and follow us on Spotify, YouTube, or the Apple Podcasts app. You can find all of our links on our Instagram at the Monstrous Feminine Podcast.
In this film, a naturalist volunteer chronicles the growth and condition of a flower on a deserted Cornish island, obsessively documenting her findings and writing No Change. Various landmarks around her hint at the island's dark past, an inoperative coal mine, a memorial to a seafaring tragedy, and an ominous standing stone. Slowly, the unnamed volunteer begins to hallucinate the island's past inhabitants, various voices and songs and lichen growing on her body.
Do you like it here on your own?
I'm not on my own.
So as you all should have picked up on, this film, the dates logged, leads up to and goes past my birthday. And yeah, I'm hearing a sigh of, ah, yes, that's, it was such a pivotal part of it for me. And I agree. Well done, guys. And I went on my birthday, I think 2021. I drove to the southern coast, drove to Seven Sisters Cliffs, and I had like a solitary walk up the cliffs. There was just no one about because it was still like off the back of lockdown and places weren't very populated. And it felt like I was, this is obviously like birthday and I feel like everyone is, well, not everyone maybe, but I'm very existential on my birthday. It's like a walk up the cliffs. And I remember trying to walk up it and feeling like, you know, like if you go hiking in the mountains, sometimes it kind of deceives you about like you're reaching the top and it looks very close and then you kind of seemingly come to like another ledge and you're like, how the fuck is there more mountain? It felt like that, and I felt like I was losing my goddamn mind because all it was, like if you've ever been to Seven Sisters, it feels just like so blank because it's just like grass and then white cliffs and then flat sea. All I was thinking of watching this film, especially like the waves and the like grass in the wind, I was like, remember that day? And I just went by myself to the cliffs. So I would go mad probably in 5 minutes.
Yeah, I was going to say, so you'd go mad literally, what you mean, immediately.
That's very surprising, Mila. Honestly, I thought you'd last the longest of us.
I think I would last for a pretty long time, to be honest.
I was going to say, I think you're my, out of all of us, I think you would last the longest for sure.
I'm both frightened and flattered.
No, it's because an Aquarius can be alone. Like, it's not going to drive you mad.
I guess it's not the isolation. It's more like the wilderness.
Honestly, it really does not bother me. Like, as long as I have, like, my basic little things, I really don't care.
Your matcha. When she said, I'm running out of tea, I was like, oh, now that's serious. Yeah, I think I would take me, like, I don't necessarily go mad, but I do get depressed, so... I think it would take me like a strong, probably after like a month, I'd be over it situation.
I'd last like a weekend, maybe, if I'm lucky. The longest amount of time I've spent alone is less than 48 hours in my entire
life. What?
Yes. Yes. I cannot be alone. I can't live alone. I can't do it. I've like house sat for like weekends and I, before the weekend is over, will invite somebody over. I can't do it. Or I need an animal there or something.
Yeah, okay. That's interesting. I feel, well, okay. I don't know. I didn't think a Gemini would fare well. I have an Aquarius moon, so I feel like I could like do it for a little bit. But ultimately, then I'm going to go a bit mad with my Libra sun and rising.
It depends, like, what's driving you mad, like, in this scenario.
The dark? I can't, like, the... Okay. I've been on many a holiday now to, like, rural UK countryside, and the dark is, like, real dark. It's scary. Like, I don't, you know when it's, like, places with truly no light, like, no street light? That scares me the fuck out. My family and I went to, like, a Welsh, like, manor situation, and we were surrounded by, like, woods. And we all, we were like, we should do the, like, a Mary Shelley challenge where we say that we'll write, everyone writes a horror story based on that setting and see what we all come up with. None of us ever actually did that. But it was the perfect setting, too, because it's scary.
To be honest, I feel so much less, like, eerie about being, like, alone in the country than I do in the city. Like, I don't know. Yeah, like, if I'm alone and I'm, like, within a city, I feel so much more, like, angsty and, like, scared because I think there's just so many other things going on. But in the country, like, if I'm genuinely by myself, I don't care.
That's what I love about the city is I never feel alone.
We've learned so much. Wait, are about you okay? Me, but, like, we need to tap into this. It's giving codependent.
As long as I'm not codependent on a particular person, I think it's
just fine. Everybody.
The Monstrous Feminine is on Spotify, so please go rate us 5 stars and comment. If you do engage with our content, you might just get a shout out on our next episode as our Witch of the Week. This episode, our Witch of the Week is Shyla, who commented on our Ma episode and said, "I'm a proud member of the Ma cult. I think Miss Spencer slayed and those goddamn teens gave her nothing to work with. Also love the Gone Girl episode and I cannot wait to be old and not a cool girl."
I'm just glad I'm not alone in the Ma cult. I felt like on an island all by myself during that episode, but it's all right because the fans had my back.
I'm sorry.
Interesting that this May Queen has said she's going to grow out of being a cool girl, because I didn't even consider that as an option, that you just grow up and stop it.
I hope you are getting some nice weather instead of 6 more weeks of winter. I hope you have lots of fun. Lots of spring desserts and little treats and nice walks and great days. You deserve it, girl.
Friendly reminder that we are also on Patreon. You can find all of the information about our tiers on our social media. Please support us. Any contribution helps.
So, background of this film. Innismain is Cornish for Stone Island. This is taking place in the days before May Day. The film was shot during the lockdown, COVID-19, and it premiered at the 2022 Cannes Film Festival, and it was promoted bilingually, and the posters were in both English and Cornish, and it was thought to be the first instance of a distributed feature film which had Cornish posters. It was shot on 16mm film. That's kind of why the colors are all saturated and lovely and vintage looking. And Mark Jenkins also directed the BAFTA award-winning film, 2019 film Bait, which explores the tensions between, like, gentrification or, like, the tourist industry and, like, the locals in Cornwall.
It's beautifully shot. The raincoats were exquisite, but there was just, it was not holding my attention. It was lulling me to sleep like a lullaby.
That's fair. I think it's fair to say that this film is, like, it gives me Jeanne Dielman vibes, where it's like her life is repetition. It's showing monotonous and tediousness of her daily existence by making you watch that. So I can understand the not enjoying it. And I think it's one of the things, or not necessarily enjoying the viewing of it necessarily, because I do think it's like one of those films where not a lot happens. That being said, I'm not going to say I didn't enjoy it. I think I did. But yeah, it's very slow. You're right. It's an experimental film. And it is at times boring, but, you know, to an effect.
To be honest, I didn't even think too much on the function necessarily of the slow pace and the monotony. And it lulled me in a more, it kind of captivated me a little bit more. Like, it had a better effect, perhaps. Because I think I was taken by just, like, it being shot on film. Like, I really like the texture of film. And so I think it holds my attention. Digital film looks quite flat sometimes. And I think that genuinely, like, your eyes can't focus on it as well as, like, film sometimes. I'm very much style over substance kind of person. Like, if I'm visually stimulated, normally I'm kind of like forgiving of whatever's going on. And I loved the raincoats, the red raincoats. It was very reminiscent of Fire of Love, the documentary, also shot on film, gorgeous nature that feels quite menacing and beautiful at the same time. I never felt like I needed necessarily the story to make sense to me. I kind of just like enjoyed the visuals. I enjoyed, again, I think, because we talked about in Wicker Man, like this very quintessential 70s UK style and aesthetic. I think they captured that so well, like not just with shooting on film, but the actors had this sort of quality to them. And I think that is in part the film, but there was just something the way they, I don't know, they captured it was so interesting. And a lot of it was almost like Sergio Leone, spaghetti western, the like extreme close-ups and the rugged landscape. And I think that to me felt like quite familiar because I love those. So loads of the stylistic elements I really liked. And then I think I wanted a little bit more horror, a little bit more, like we got a lot of folk, not so much the horror. And I'm curious, like if you guys got a sense of that. I got like a little bit of like Oogie Boogie, but not, I wanted a little bit more.
It's one of those ones where it's like eerie, not so much horror. It's like a creeping up of slow dread rather than like a scary.
I don't think the end, it didn't balance out the like very slow burn of it for me. I wanted a bit more like.
Of a climax. I agree, actually.
I think this film was like very much in the realm of films that are considered like elevated horror or like post-horror, which is a term that I don't agree with completely, but I could tell that it was trying to be artistic. And like, it's not that it isn't, because as you said, it's shot on film and it's really, really beautifully shot. And that's like the redeeming factor here. But I just feel like it doesn't feel like horror. And horror doesn't have, horror is a genre that does have specific conventions and tropes and things to play by. But it is very expansive and imaginary, and you can kind of play with those things. But I don't feel like this film really engages with anything in horror except for grief. And I've noticed that a lot of films that are trying to fit within that like elevated horror type will take grief as a thing that they put in. I mean, you see it in some of the most successful recent horror films like Talk to Me, but that was a good ass movie. And like Midsommar has grief, Hereditary. Like a lot of them really explore that. And with this film, it went with a more experimental angle, but I just don't feel like it actually ended up working because you don't feel the horror. I know you're supposed to be like in the character's shoes and experiencing her life with her and like slowly feeling the anxiety and dread and fear creep up. But instead, to me, I just felt like, I felt like it was very hard to focus on what was going on. I could feel that it was trying to do that. And so that was really what was not vibing for me.
I think I'm sort of like between all of y'all. Like I do think it was horror. I do think it was beautifully shot. I wasn't mad at the pacing. Like I think the no change was very effective actually. But I don't think the interruptions to the monotony were severe enough. And if it was a true horror, those interruptions would be like very jarring and memorable. And I feel like I'm sitting here trying to think like, okay, what was the first no change disruption? I guess it was the lichen on the flower. She starts having like hallucinations, but even those kind of just blend into each other. Like I can't, like the miners, the visions of the miners come at the same time as the visions of the like, I don't know, I'll call them like milkmaids or like the little kids or like the singing.
They are called bal maidens, the Cornish word referring to female coal miners. And then the children in white, I don't know who they are. They're just children in white.
Yeah. Or even like the radio, like the radio, I feel like wasn't utilized enough. Like it just felt like it had all the groundworks for things that I would have really enjoyed, and they just chose not to take those paths for whatever reason. Like maybe because they'd be considered predictable in the horror genre. I would even go so far as to say that this is maybe like a thriller and not a horror. But like there were just moments where it felt like they were trying so hard to like not do the predictable thing that it missed out on like very juicy opportunities to like like shake the audience up a bit, because like, what's the point of doing this tool of monotony if it's not to highlight the things that are not the monotony? Like, I just felt like the things that were not no change just never stood out enough for me. And then in addition to all that, then by the end, I'm like, not only am I confused about what she has experienced and what I've experienced, quite frankly, like, I never felt a revelation. Like, the revelation doesn't have to come at the end. And I think a lot of great horror doesn't have a satisfying ending. But there should be a moment of revelation, or a moment where I, as the audience, get to feel satisfied that I've, like, figured out what's going on. And it just feels like a little bit indulgent to just, like, never give the audience any of that. To just be like, it's just vibes. Because you have presented a plot. As much as you want it to be just vibes, like, you've promised me a plot and then not delivered. And I think that is where I got frustrated, is like, not only do I not have all the puzzle pieces to put together for myself, I think there's still some few pieces missing, in a way where, like, I can't even, like, sit around and hypothesize about what happened effectively in my mind. But at the same time, like, I was entertained. Like, it did keep, like, I wasn't sleepy. I felt engaged because I was trying to figure it out. And then at the end, I'm like, oh, what? I didn't even get to figure it out. And you didn't figure it out for me. Like, any aspect of it. So, like, maybe that's just, like, me not enjoying this particular approach. But it doesn't mean I didn't enjoy the film.
I feel like partially the reason why the film doesn't, like, wrap up in the ending is because we're kind of playing with the character's memory. And so memory is like a funny thing that is not always satisfying. Like, you don't always remember things correctly or end up with a full picture of what something is or what's happening. So I kind of feel like that's why. But I don't know, like, I can see that there's so much thought put behind some of the decisions in the film. And I think the no change and the monotony and all of it is nice, in a sense that you're, like, building up this world of this very slow burn until, like, you start to question her sanity and the experience and what's happening. And is she remembering these people? How does she know this man that she thinks she may have had a relationship with in the past? What is she experiencing? And it feels like the character herself is grieving to me. But I just feel like Zabe was saying, like, I feel like we're promised a plot that never is put together. And I understand that it's like an experimental way to think of viewing a story from a character's point of view, because characters aren't movies. They don't come up with these conclusive endings or give audiences all the answers. But because this is still a movie, I wanted more. Like, I wanted more story. I wanted more plot. I don't necessarily need action, because I do love a slow burn movie, and that wasn't necessarily the problem. I just think the movie itself, like, at some point, I just stopped feeling like there was a plot.
Going back to Wicker Man, we were trying to put a name to the vibes of folk horror. I still can't. I have no fucking clue. It is a slow burn, normally. Well, not always a slow burn, but I think it does well with a slower pace, because I think that a lot of the sort of building of horror comes from kind of establishing, like, a normal, or, like, you know, a normal community and, you know, how they operate, and then kind of, like, slowly twisting and subverting it. But I agree, Zaba, that the interruptions to that weren't as effective for me. I don't know if I necessarily need very explicit or overt interruptions necessarily in a horror for it to feel like true horror. But I do agree that, like, those, it didn't work so much. In a sense, I didn't even consider it a horror, like, when I finished it. But the plot being kind of absent, one might say, I think it's interesting, like, hearing you guys talk about it, because I think it reveals, like, how it is quite different, like, what each of us want from horror. I think that I'm realizing that I like prioritize a sort of feeling over a narrative. I don't really care what it's about or if the story is necessarily present or strong, but if it doesn't like elicit the right feelings for me, I sort of get frustrated, if that makes sense. And this film did, I mean, the feelings I had were, I was just admiring it. So that's obviously not like the function of horror so much. It had like moments in it where I felt like a little bit disturbed is too strong. Like I felt sort of, you said eerie, like there was an eerie, unsettling kind of sinking in your stomach a little bit, but not enough that I would, I don't know, feel satisfied with it as a horror. But I liked the folk elements. Like Ty, you were mentioning the sort of more like quote unquote art house horrors that people have said have had a resurgence recently. Is like the sort of tendency for art house like naturally to be a little bit more adverse to plot because they're prioritizing style as an expression of ideas and feelings. Does that work well with horror? Maybe it doesn't all the time because horror relies maybe on a lot of contextualization and stories and like human driven motivations. I don't know, maybe that's not the case, but I think it is maybe what we see more of is these like experimental horrors that they flail about a little bit with the story. I've noticed like we in general, it's not that we always don't like them, but I think that we resonate so much more strongly maybe with like story driven horrors, especially like because we're coming at it like analyzing the genre. So we're kind of already aware of the conventions and the tropes. So maybe we kind of want to see like a self-awareness of that as well, which like art house doesn't really leave room for.
Just feels a bit contrarian. Like if you're going to break the tropes, at least acknowledge they exist one time. I don't know.
I think that it's kind of like in that, yeah, it's kind of like a psychological thriller. It's like a psychodrama, but I think that it's porous enough to be considered a horror. In some ways, I actually really like, because Zabi mentioned how the no change moments didn't stand out enough for you. I kind of really liked the subtlety of it because I think that's what heightens the sense of madness or like, you know, and I say madness is like not necessarily politically correct term. Let me say that heightens a sense of like self-doubt or like an unreliable narrator or like anything like that. I really like the kind of slow build of moments that really confuse the chronology of events. Like the film's non-linearity, I think, is done well because it's so subtle. For example, in Variety, list a couple of these moments, but the kind of radio report refers to the memorial of the victims of a sea tragedy that was erected in 1973, but May 1973, but the volunteer says that, you know, this is, as we know from her, it's only April, so it hasn't taken place yet. Equally, the actual sign says that it took place in 1897, and it was a tragedy that also took place on the 1st of May in 1897. Other glitches appear, like she finds the cut flower, and then we see her cut the flower herself a few days later. She mounts a piece from the kind of boat that, like, you know, crashed or something, the probably from the seafaring tragedy. She mounts it on her mantel place, but then we see the boat and it's intact when the kind of fisherman or boatman comes to visit her. She finds the kind of yellow like coat from a drowned victim, but then later, like, you know, he's wearing it. There's blood dripping from presumably her like midriff slash, but like either she had that wound way in the past or has yet to have it. It's kind of unclear. So I think I quite like all these things, and I think I like them to what they're doing in the sense of like collapsing every single moment of previous Maydays onto itself. I think it does make a lot of the radio. I kind of disagree with that point. I think there's at one point in the film where we hear it just repeatedly say, Mayday, 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 which is like a clever play on words between the actual like seafaring tragedy that happened, but also like Mayday, the event. And I also like it in the sense of like, we've talked about folklore or folk horror being like somewhat self-conscious of its own genre, its own lore. I think this film is, interestingly, it's set in 1973, but it's made in 2022, right? So Like, it's conscious of the history in which, or the context in which it's setting itself. So I think in this particular film, there's a lot of, like, undercurrent of, I think The Wicker Man was like, we've talked about it being, it's political in the sense of, like, undercurrents of, like, the crisis of morality and, like, Christianity coming up against and, like, you know, what does it mean? What belief system do we have? But here, I think it's more overtly political in its kind of almost trade unionism references. So in 1973, an estimated 1.6 million workers in the United Kingdom stopped work and went on strike in support of the Trade Union Congress Day of National Protest and Stoppage against the government's pay restraint policy and pay price rises. And I think this film's very concerned with a legacy of workers' rights, with just like the abandoned coal mine shots, the fact that every time we see or hear them, they're like coughing excessively. It like seems to be some sort of comment on like workers' conditions. The fact that it's so derelict and abandoned, much like these coal mining communities actually were in the UK. So I think for that reason, I kind of like the slow conflation and subtle moments where we're confused in time as leading us towards like these many different tragedies that have happened to take place on the same day.
But why is she so affected by them? Like, why is she a naturalist? Why is she so haunted by this particular history?
I think this is the typical folklore tradition of like the land's history seeping into your own subconscious or consciousness. Like, you cannot avoid it. I think it's like slowly making her more affected. Like, there's an ambiguity of like how much she's personally involved, right? Like, does she have an affair with this fisherman guy? Is this fisherman guy like the original victim from 1897? Because which case she don't know him. But like, has she been dead the whole time? Like, did she die in her youth when she sustained that midriff slash? Like, was she in one of the hallucinations, like, she sees herself, like, rescuing, like, the boatman. But then we know from that tragedy that everybody who went to rescue that guy who drowned ended up drowning themselves. Like, is she part of that tragedy? I think, like, her connection to the lore is, like, ambiguous. Either she was personally connected or maybe she's just, like, injecting herself through memory, which is just a past, like, that's coming to haunt her, like, as if it's personal, even if it's not. And I quite like it. I think I'm usually actually the one who doesn't like the art house horrors we do. So I'm feeling, like, very in the atypical position here on the podcast. But I quite liked it for what it's doing. I also think there's some really interesting, like, environmentalism points, but I'd rather hear what you guys have to say about any of that.
I was going to say that this film feels like it falls under an archaic mother trope, because the lichen is like one of the oldest living organisms, and it is like slowly growing throughout the film until she starts to have like actual patches of skin on her, which feels like a reabsorption thing, especially with her connection to the land and the way that she starts experiencing all of these memories and like feeling the grief of things that have happened there. It feels as though she is kind of being reabsorbed by the archaic mother, which is the land, but she's specifically being absorbed by the lichen that she's reporting on and seeing no change over. So I think this kind of goes with like archaic mother, even though I still say that this does not really feel like a horror film.
Yeah, I think that's interesting with the archaic mother reading, because I think nature is presented really well in this film as something that's both beautiful and dangerous, like the way it's captured, to like Louisa was saying, the sort of subtle indisplacing of reality and her fever dreams and hallucinations. I think that nature like grounds it with a menacing kind of atmosphere. But the folklore aspect, I wasn't sure how relevant it was to the story, which goes back to like, is the story that important? Who knows? But I think sometimes I wasn't quite sure like what folklore they were really referring to as it related to like what was going on with the lead character. But I think hearing you talk a bit more like about the miners, the fishermen, these accidents all coinciding, Mayday, it's taking like the sort of history, the sense of history of folklore, and like situating it in more recent tragedies as they relate to nature, like the mines. I think it was a tin mine. It's referring back to nature as this reoccurring theme, the dangers of it, but also when we exploit it, that's sort of environmentalism coming back. But I think it's hard not to read more into, like, for example, the miners. I mean, this is like early 70s, but end of 70s into the 80s with like Thatcherism, the miners' strikes. And I wondered if that was maybe a retrospective kind of thing with the filmmaker. It felt very intentional. And to be honest, I don't know why they were there, but I didn't need to. I really didn't need to. Because I felt like it just having like this sort of grounding, ominous feeling.
I want to jump on the mention of nature and menacing nature. So I think environmentalism is like an extremely important part of this film because of the book that she's reading throughout the film, which is called A Blueprint for Survival. And this was a 1972 book that was originally published by The Ecologist. This is Wiki's summary. Okay, so I'm just going to read. But it was an influential environmentalist text that drew attention to the urgency and magnitude of environmental problems. The blueprint was signed by over 30 of the leading scientists of the day who argued for a radically restructured society in order to prevent what the authors referred to as, quote, the breakdown of society and the irreversible disruption of the life support systems on this planet. End quote. It recommended that people live in small, decentralized, and largely deindustrialized communities. Some of the reasons given for this were that, quote, it is too difficult to enforce moral behavior in a large community. Two, agricultural and business practices are more likely to be ecologically sound in smaller communities. Three, people feel more fulfilled in smaller communities. And four, reducing an area's population reduces the environmental impact. Still reading from Wikipedia. But the authors used tribal societies as their model, which, it was claimed, were characterized by their small, human-scale communities, low-impact technologies, successful population control, sustainable resource management, holistic and ecologically integrated worldviews, and a high degree of social cohesion and physical health, psychological well-being, and spiritual fulfillment. End quote. I know that was a lot. But I think with that being like the text that she's so fixated on, honestly, we see it in like so many different shots. I think that adds another layer to this. I think it adds another layer to the kind of non-linearity as well. It almost feels like, it might be a bit of a stretch, but it almost feels like somewhat like, I just have this foreboding sense of doom. To me, that feels almost like apocalyptic. One reviewer, Sheila O'Malley for Roger Ebert, said that Ennismen takes place in the borderland of transformation where past and present and a terrifying future coexist, where boundaries blur, and where, quote, no change is ominous because if there's one constant in the universe, it's that everything changes. This woman's reading material speaks to the overall anxiety of humans' desire to make a world they can live in. Maybe it's too late. And the fact that she's a naturalist, the fact that she's like analyzing lichen, it just, which apparently, like, I looked up a little bit about what the significance of lichen could be. Apparently, it actually can grow. According to Wikipedia, the European Space Agency found that it can grow in space in like crazy conditions. It will still survive. And it's almost like this apocalyptic plant. So for me, just there seems to be a lot of like anxiety about future, past, tragedy as related to key industries like coal mining, fishermen communities. I don't know. And as that generates a lot of grief. And then all of that kind of bleeding into the present, confusing the chronology, and also creating a sense of doom about the future. That's kind of how I read it. I mean, maybe I'm giving everything too much credit, but I think it was successful for me. I was disturbed, and I did get this kind of apocalyptic sense as tied to the environment. Not least of all because the environment is so beautifully exaggerated by the mode of the film as well. Like, I think your attention's really drawn to it. And there's shots of like where I think they've deliberately rolled the like film backwards. Like it shows the sea kind of playing backwards and there's drips in a coal mine cave where the water is actually going up. Like I think he's just reversed the film or whatever. I just kind of got this sense of like all of that as tied to like our governance in the UK.
I obviously like
probably conceived of this film before the pandemic and then it was filmed during, but these themes of like environmental collapse and isolation, and like it's hard to ignore like in the context of when it came out and probably the reception of it when it did. But what you're saying, Louisa, about it feeling like post-apocalyptic, and also this context you're giving about like the plan laid out by the book that she's reading, it feels almost a bit nihilistic in like the way that all sort of like apocalyptic movies are, in that like the lichen will survive. The lichen will eat your body if you die here. The lichen will eat the flowers. It doesn't matter if you are committed to the preservation of nature the way that she is. Like, you touched it and a lichen grew. You fucked this shit up is kind of what I interpreted that as. Like, you messed up the experiment and you got it all over yourself. And so, like, obviously something like a mine or overfishing or unregulated use of land is going to lead to bad things in the environment, bad things for communities. But I also am like skeptical, and I think maybe she is skeptical the longer she stays there, of this like belief that, oh, if we just lived in these like less industrialized, like smaller, tight-knit communities, if we were just able to like live in isolation, or if we were just able to not touch nature as much as possible, not intervene, just observe and take notes. And I guess my question all throughout is like, what is she gathering this information for? Like, for what purpose? And that's never revealed to us, because she really did the same thing every day, walked the same path, did not like go upsetting the land in any way besides cutting the flower and touching it briefly. And both of those things had like, were to her own detriment in the end. And it kind of like, that's what's unsettling to me, is it feels like there's nothing she could have done. There's no way she could have acted that would have prevented the inevitability of like the land just taking itself back. Like, that's the thing in all these apocalypse things, is like, it's buildings that have been taken down by the vines, and it's like trees that were able to grow after human civilization collapsed, and the oceans will just take us back. Like, that imagery is super familiar, in at least in like sci-fi and in like types of horror that like take from those tropes. And like, this does it in like you're saying, these really, really, really subtle ways, but our attention is drawn to them because fuck all else is happening in like in front of us. I would give it that credit of like at least engaging with how people in history affect land. Now, this question of like, what is the folklore of this place? Like, if we're putting it in the folk category, I kind of wish it was more, a little more history-based and less like speculative. Like, we're left to speculate a little bit too much on the folklore. Whereas like, for me, what makes folklore horror effective as folklore horror is like being able to chew on the information given or the information withheld. And I just feel like you were relying a little bit too much on like somebody like Louisa going up and like, okay, you've shown me this book for the third time, let me go and look it up and then tell my friends what it is. Because I think, like, I don't know, if I was watching this in the theater and I didn't have like, and I was sort of like looking up contextual things as I watched, I think details like that would have slipped my mind. Or like the frustration at, I don't know, even like knowing the history of like mining in Cornwall, or like knowing the like, or why is this place abandoned? Like, not abandoned. Well, it's been abandoned. There were people there. Like, I'm sitting around wondering, like, why is it that there is no people anymore? Was there an accident making it inhabitable? Like, is the lichen like something that is like harmful to human health? Like, why have people been driven out of this place? Is it that it's considered useless and there's no longer any resources? Is it that people physically cannot live here anymore? Is it that like the land will eat you alive at some point if you stay too long? Like, I just had so many unanswered questions about like the isolation aspect of it. And like, I think it does, like, the isolation does a great job of like driving the like us empathizing with the character and feeling like the anxiety that the character is feeling. But I don't understand why she is alone. Like, what happened here? And I think that, like, I don't know, I can sit around and think about what happened to Cornwall generally and have that historical context, but what happened on this island? I think that's the thing that I'm too hung up on to do research, I guess, because the island is fake.
presumably. I mean, like, islands like this exist, but this is, like, meant to be our hypothetical island that, like, we are thinking about.
Replying to, like, the more recent thing you said in terms of, I kind of agree that actually I had no, like, basis for the folklore, but maybe, and this isn't a criticism to the film, like, I wonder if it's kind of something that, like, Cornish people would watch and it would feel obvious. Like, this, it would be so seamless, the storytelling, because they obviously knew it. Because it might be that it's just, like, deliberately inaccessible in a way. But when Louisa was, you were talking about the book Blueprint for Survival, was it called? That you said they were sourcing inspiration from tribal communities. And it just kind of like gave me like a brain zap about how, we talked a little bit about when we did Wicker Man, about how like the portrayal of these pagan folklores or communities, often there's a savagery or primitive kind of characterization of their beliefs and their rituals and their ways. It made me like feel quite aware then maybe of how it's a capitalistic tool to kind of frame these communities, like non-white, quote unquote, tribal communities, ridicule, dehumanize them to create this sort of idea of progress and the future, something that's increasingly industrialized and away from this way of living that like is in harmony with the environment and the land. The Cornish identity is very separate from English, but it's more like a general sort of post-industrial revolution feels so British because that's how it's been like, how it's been kind of ingrained in us. So the way that people kind of have cultivated like a new national identity, I don't know. I think this film actually does kind of draw, not like, I'm not saying I'm going, this isn't watching, but like as a jumping off point for discussion, I think it's very interesting. And I think that's also like some of where the spaghetti Western like feeds in for me, is this sort of need to like reflect on the land and the sense of place as it relates to nation building. And it was just, yeah, I think it does feel, it feels like impending doom linked to a sort of environmental collapse. Like, I think that has completely like a nail on the head, like what I was feeling watching it and didn't even realize. But I don't know if this is you guys like feeding interesting conversation and I'm like projecting it back onto the film.
I really liked Louisa giving the environmentalist angle and discussing the contents of the book. I like that angle better and it makes it a bit more interesting to me overall as a film, especially because I think it's quite timely. We have a lot of individualism going on at the moment because I think there is so much pessimistic thoughts about climate and climate change to the point where people are like, well, it doesn't really matter what I do because ultimately everything will happen the way that it's always going to happen. The world is going to end, whatever. But I think there has to be like this sense of individual accountability as well as a collective accountability for doing less harm to the earth. And thinking about it from this angle, especially like the occupations that are highlighted, as well as her being someone who is supposed to, I guess, like study and preserve the earth. She's also a volunteer though. So, I mean, is it really her job? But I think when you have like such an increase in tourism in Antarctica at the moment and an overusage of private jets and just so many things that are really harmful to the earth, and the response is overwhelmingly quite individualistic. But I think the impacts of those things are much worse because we do live in such large, condensed cities. So like you feel the pollution harder, you feel the destruction harder. So while in this film, it feels like it's a very slow burn until we start to see like the earth take itself back, I think it's kind of scary to think about into relation to what's actually happening in the world, because it's not really slow. It is quite fast. You can kind of feel it, the earth getting, well, like in each city that we all live in, like I'm sure we felt the city's seasons kind of change, like the winter maybe hotter, or like sometimes it's much colder, and these things are happening very rapidly, but the ability to ignore them is because we have like so many other things going on. But in this film, because there's nothing going on, you have no choice but to observe every little small change, and it feels so magnified in contrast to what we currently have in modern day, where the changes are happening quite rapidly every single day, but we aren't noticing them because there's so many other things going on. I think those contrasted together are quite interesting, and it gives a lot of perspective to maybe how we should pay more attention to the smaller things and live slowly and more intentionally to cause less harm.
I wanted to pick up on what you said, Zeba, because you cast a little bit of doubt about the 4-point plan of the blueprint of survival. And I wanted to say, in like kind of true kind of nebulous British filmmaking tradition, is that I think it is a little bit ambiguous whether it's saying that this community that lived before was the ideal or if it wasn't. I think it's actually kind of potentially hinting that it wasn't. If we go back to what the 4 rules were, it was moral behavior is probably better in a small community. It was agriculture and business practices are more likely to be ecologically sound in a smaller community. People feel more fulfilled and it reduces the environmental impact. And I'm not sure, because of the whole coal mining lore, if it's like trying to say that that actually wasn't the case. And, you know, there was tragedy here. People weren't as fulfilled. If it's like casting doubt on that idea, or if it's trying to say that that wasn't possible because of the sheer prevalence of industry. Like, I think with folklore, we do have this like overwhelming feeling in it with British folklore, especially like of like towns and industry and like encroaching on the countryside. And it's saying like that like infiltrated here and it ruined what would have been a kind of pastoral idyll. So yeah, I think that is interesting. I think it is left a little bit ambiguous. I would argue that it's kind of showing that there was potential for it, but it wasn't fulfilled because of the kind of coal mine. And we know that that's like bad for the environment. It was obviously bad for their health. They were like coughing. We know that tragedy took place here. It's kind of cast a little bit of doubt on that. I do really like what you said about this being like the lichen reclaiming the land and it being archaic mother. In fact, I would argue that's probably one of the few instances of mon femme that we have here. I do agree, Zeba, that I would like a little bit more of the lore. For example, we have the standing stone, and I feel like we could have had more about that specifically. I was kind of waiting for an explanation of like what happened here. Potentially like a pagan illusion or something, but that seemed a bit missing. So I was kind of waiting for that. Besides it just simply being there and being ominous, I kind of wanted to hear more about that lore. So I think that was potentially not as developed as other elements. But yeah, I do put this quite squarely in a folk horror category. I think going back to that documentary I quoted, Woodland Stark and Days Bewitched, they say, if you think of in Westerns and American films, the mythic America is the extending, expanding landscape, the dream of moving onto new territory that hasn't been picked over. Whereas in folk horror, the British tradition, it's more about depth rather than moving outward. And what I mean to say that is, or what I think they mean to say, is that there's so much focus on like the soil, the earth going down. And of course, here we have like a coal mine, which is quite literally that, right? Interestingly, also in that documentary, Piers Haggard, who directed The Blood on Satan's Claw, he said that when he was shooting that, he did many shots like from the earth, like from really down below, because he was trying to exaggerate that connection with like the soil. And folk horror is all about the sense of something really sinister that's been buried that is now seeping up into the present day, as literally depicted as something emerging from the ground, but also as like with psychological undertones as well. A BFI article about this film said that Ennis Main shares with folk horror its concern with what lies deep in the land, with buried archaic connections between humans and natural forces, which still exert an influence over the living. In Jenkins' film, these connections are rooted in the physical reality of death, in the decomposed bodies of past inhabitants whose broken down components have become a part of the sea and the soil. End quote. And I think maybe in a similar way that Piers Haggard had like all those shots from the ground, I think this film also does that. I mean, we have so many close-up shots of like her boots and you can hear the pebble, gravel, and whatever of her walking. so many shots of her picking up stuff from the soil, from her dropping that stone down into the soil. I thought, and I was kind of expecting it, and it maybe would have been better, but I thought the climax of the film was going to be her jumping into that coal mine. I felt that would have been really good. But anyway, it didn't happen. All that to say is that there is like such a focus on soil, on earth, on digging, on depth. Thank you for listening to the Monstrous Feminine podcast, produced and hosted by Zeba Aurora, Taya Burnett, Mila F., and Louisa Johnson. Big thanks also go to Sebastian Pizarro for our wonderful theme music. Be sure to follow us on Instagram, SoundCloud, and Spotify at the Monstrous Feminine podcast and on Twitter at the Monfem Pod. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, and follow us on TikTok at the Monstrous Feminine Pod for podcast clips and more fun. All information can be found on our website, www.themonstrousfemininepodcast.com. We hope you enjoyed this episode. Brooms up, witches out.